Bless you. Good morning. For those of you that may be new to the church, we've been going through the book of John, and unfortunately, you've just reached the last bit. So you're going to have to get the previous recordings. I'm not sure how we record them these days. They'll all be digital and online. I'm of the age, and I don't think I'm that old, but I'm of the age where I'm the preacher's generation that usually says, get the tape. And that's a while ago now. And some of you are like, what's a tape? So we're in that zone. We're going to be in John 21, and I'm going to be speaking a little bit about Peter this morning. Peter, whose nickname is Rocky. He is one of the disciples of Jesus. He's probably the oldest disciple of Jesus. So when you look at the group of them, we believe that John, who's the author of this book, was the youngest. When he was first following Jesus, he's probably around 13, 14 years old. So Jesus is the first youth worker in the history of the church. And also, Peter is into adulthood, certainly. He's married at this point as well. So Peter's certainly the older one. And if you look at the track record of rabbis and their disciples, generally speaking, the disciple that it's expected to try and answer the questions first is the oldest one. So one of the things that we read as we read the stories in the Gospels is that Peter's often the one that speaks up first. Now, it's probably a twofold component. One, he's supposed to. He's the oldest disciple. But what's clear about Peter is he engages mouth before brain. And none of us are guilty of that. None of us. It's very unique to Peter. And none of us can relate to him whatsoever. Because none of us have found ourselves in a position where we've engaged mouth before brain, have we? And so what's interesting about the book of John, and I mentioned it in some previous messages, is that John's the last disciple now. They've all gone, and John's the last one. And so if you think about this book and when it was written, all the other disciples he talks about are dead. So he's not talking about Peter as if Peter's still with him. So he's passing on personal narrative story, eyewitness testimony that he saw, but he's also passing on the legacy of the other disciples in what he's writing. Now, he's going to be aware of some of the circulating scriptures that were written about Jesus. He would have been aware of the book of Mark and the book of Matthew and probably the book of Luke. So he's trying to add to the story or tell the story, and in doing so, he's trying to reveal more, but he's also trying to leave a legacy as the last disciple. And so John is taking his time to write this. Now, the way I think about John writing this book is either he wrote it himself or he talked to somebody who wrote down the words. And so it's one or the other. So I've either got a picture in my mind of John as an old bloke sitting down at his writing table, desk, with a quill, penning away, or with somebody who's interpreting it into the Greek for him, and speaking or telling the stories and getting them, write this down, write it down like that. No, change that word, write it down like that. I've got an idea of which. Now, in my head, I also play with it and think, I wonder if John played out the scenarios, if he's speaking to an interpreter, to create the feel. And in this chapter, we're at a beach having breakfast. And so part of me is thinking, either John is reliving this, or he's reliving it as he's writing it, or he's playing it out. Either way, this is a fragment of history, a moment of history, where John is reliving a moment of breakfast with Jesus after the resurrection. Now, one of the questions I was asking myself as I was reading through this text and preparing is, why didn't he stop at chapter 20? You'll have heard Mark announce last week that we finished it and then remembered that we're actually going through the last chapter. Because, of course, chapter 20 ends with, you know, Jesus is risen again. Hallelujah. It's all fine. We're going to heaven. And that whole narrative that this is, you know, the story is you get to go to heaven when you die, which turns Christianity into fire insurance, as you've heard me call it before. But that isn't the end of the story. John chooses not to end the story where all the other authors end the story. Have you noticed? The resurrection appearances, and then the commission that we see written down in Mark and in Matthew, and then that's it. Luke kind of out of sequence because he writes the book of Acts too. So Acts carries on from Luke, and at one point it was actually just one book. But it's interesting that John chooses to put one more chapter in, which is the chapter that Mark forgot about. No, it's the forgotten chapter. Gosh, now it sounds like a real sermon. So I'm just going to read a few verses from chapter 21, and I might pause, as you know I'm in the habit of doing. But let's keep going with chapter 21. After these things, that's after Jesus has met with the disciples, the tomb is empty, there's the resurrection appearances. After these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, otherwise known as the Sea of Galilee. And he manifested himself in this way. What? Why are you? John's making a point. He always is making a point. John's always trying to make a point. There's always another layer. Yeah? That's the A1 message from the Gospel of John. There's always another layer. Manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter. Who's Simon Peter? He's the one that denied Jesus 3 chapters ago. So Simon's the denier. 3 times he denied Jesus. Thomas, he's the one who doubted Jesus, called Didymus. And Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, that's James and John the author, and 2 others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." And they said to him, "We'll come with you." It's kind of a nice little jaunt, really, isn't it? Let's go angling. Apparently, it's the most dangerous sport. More people die of fishing than of any other sport, which is fascinating. And that's a complete segue from any of my notes. Hadn't planned to say that at all. Mouth before brain. They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. But when the day was breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Yet the disciples did not know who it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, "Children, you do not have any fish, do you?" They answered him, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the other side of the boat, and you'll find a catch." So they cast, and when they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish, therefore the disciple who Jesus loved, that's John, said to Peter, "It's the Lord." So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, not something we do these days, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, about 100 yards away, dragging in the net of fish. You've just finished with the resurrection. You've just finished with this huge story of Jesus rising again from the dead, the empty tomb, defeating death, defeating sin, eternity in the hands of those who are his followers, and now we're having a fish fry. That's interesting that the last man standing would choose to end his book with a story like this. Of all the things he could have chosen to write about, he chooses to end the story with this. Think about that for a moment. He's written about the seas stilling and all the choices, the miracles that he could have told, retold, or do you remember when's, or a sit down with the disciples recounting the stories, or transferring the meaning of everything and writing some deep, meaningful exercise. He chooses to end the story, end his book. He chooses to end it with a story of breakfast, kippers. Why? Like, the last chapter you leave them is this chapter. And it's not even about John. There's a little bit at the end which is a bit about him, but it really isn't. It's about Peter. And he tells the story of when they met Jesus, who's risen again, by the Sea of Galilee. And they didn't recognize him to begin with, and they'd gone fishing. Why did Peter go fishing? Peter's a fisherman. We read right at the very beginnings of the Gospels how the first disciples were called with a miracle like this. You'll find it in Luke chapter 5. And in Luke chapter 5, you've got the story of Jesus walking along the shore, teaching. There's some boats there. And so he tells the disciples, after he's finished teaching, let's go out in the boats and go fishing. And they go out fishing and humor the rabbi, because rabbis don't know anything about fishing. They've grown up as fishermen. Their fathers were fishermen. Their grandfathers were fishermen. Their families were fishermen. Everybody knows fishing in our family. We're expert fishermen. And so they go and push out for fishermen. And this rabbi, who's a carpenter, so he's got splinters in his hand, has no idea how to fish, tells them, let's go fishing. They go out. They don't catch anything. So he tells them to put the nets on the other side of the boat, because everybody knows that there's more fish on that side of the boat than on that side of the boat. No, all good fishermen know there's a season and a time when they're biting and when they're not, and it's not about which side of the boat you put your fishing net on or your fishing rod on. But they humour the rabbi, and so they put the fishing net on the other side of the boat, thinking, what does he know? And then suddenly there's this massive catch of fish, and they think, good grief, he's even a better fisherman than us. And Peter, we read the story, gets down on his knees and he says, depart from me, I'm a sinful man, I'm not worthy to be in your presence. And Jesus, rather than turn around to them and say, you're absolutely right, you're not worthy to be in my presence, which is quite true, he turns around to them and says, I want you to follow me and I'll teach you to become fishers of men. That's the story. There's a little nuance in the story in Luke, which we don't read in John. In John, they're fishing in shallow water. In Luke chapter 5, it says Jesus tells them to go out into deep water. They're fishing in the shallows again. They're not out in the deep water. I wonder if they just pushed a bit further out. I don't think they did. They stayed fishing in the shallows and the miracle happened in the shallows. Previously, the miracle happened in the deep water. Fascinating. There's more you can read into that. John's playing with it. I'm not going to spend time going into that today. That's something for you guys to have fun with at some point. Why does he tell us to push out into deep waters and other times tell us to fish in the shallows? I don't know. What I do know is there are times when life is easy and there are times where God makes life intentionally difficult. And yet in both cases, there's fruit. In both cases, there's reward. In both cases, there's fish. And sometimes we can read too much into methodology and too much into systems and processes and the way we do it. And we become under-dependent on just listening to what God tells us to do in the moment. That's about as close as I can get. But there are seasons when God's going to tell us, should be fishing in deep waters. Or you're looking on the wrong side. And there are other seasons where God's saying, just fish where you are. Interesting. Often we try and program it in. I remember God once spoke to me and he says, don't be a David in this situation. Be an Elisha. And I didn't. It was a situation where I had a choice to run at something or stand back. And normally I'd have run at it. And God told me to stand back and let him deal with it. Sometimes God will tell us to do things which are against our natural skill set, knowledge. We know what to do, right? This is an interesting story for me because Peter's gone back to fishing. Now, a few chapters before, you'll read it in John 18, there's the story of Peter denying Jesus in front of a group. What's happened is Jesus has been arrested, he's been taken to the high priest's house, Annas, and Peter has managed to wrangle his way into the courtyard where he's being held because John is a friend of the high priest, and so John's able to kind of convince the servant girl to let Peter in. Peter comes in, and initially, as he's walking in, the lady that's at the door says, you're one of his followers, aren't you? No, I'm not one of his followers. The reason why he says, no, I'm not one of his followers is because he's frightened of being caught and being identified. And he doesn't want to be caught out, even though we know from the words of Jesus that he says, if you deny me before men, I will deny you before my Father. And I've even heard people teach and preach that Peter isn't actually saved anymore because he denied Jesus and won't be in heaven. Maybe that's one of the reasons why John wrote this chapter. So, Peter is standing with a group of people, and it says, in the text, it says that Peter is stood around with the slaves and the officers, with the servants and the officers of the high priest, around a charcoal fire, warming himself. And so he's keeping warm. And then somebody says, aren't you the guy that cut off that guy's ear? No, it's not me. Three times, denies. And then the rooster crows, and one of the other Gospels records that he ran out weeping bitterly. You'll read in Matthew 26 how Peter, when he is in the Last Supper, and Jesus says to his disciples, all of you are going to leave me, all of you are going to scatter, we read that Peter turns around and says, I won't. I will go to my death for you. I won't deny you. And Jesus turns around and says, three times you'll deny me this evening. And Peter says, no way. He engages mouth before brain because he doesn't realize that God knows him better than he does. But so often we're convinced that in our actions we're right and God's wrong. And God's way of meekness and compassion and grace and kindness and reconciliation is wrong because there are some people that just need to be told. God doesn't know me as well as I do. Or, maybe we put it a different way, some of us, when we get into our gatherings as believers, become so hyped up by the scenario of faith in the room that we start to proclaim things about what we will do and what we will be and the things that we will do for God. I will tell the world about Jesus. I will never say no. And we find ourselves 3 weeks later being caught by the boss for reading our Bible. No, it's not a Bible. It's not a Bible. It's not. How quickly our facade, our confidence starts to just tip. Likewise, press the pause button, the rewind button, and come back to what do we expect from our leaders? Bear in mind, Peter's died. John's writing this about Peter, and Peter has spent his entire life building the church. Peter was once pronounced upon by Jesus, saying, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven, and on this rock I will build my church. On this, Peter, I will build my church. This great moment, he comes crashing down a few verses later when Jesus turns around and says, get me behind me, Satan. We'll ignore that one for a moment. Peter has this great high and weight of expectations of you're going to build the church. You're going to be the one on which I build this entire thing. And one of the reasons why the Catholic Church takes that as the centerpiece is because they believe that that Peter was the head of the church. And so we have this succession of heads. But John is speaking into a world that has had Peter been and gone, but Peter has stood up and helped build the church, written two letters. And we've got the words of Peter still. And into this, God speaks to us and says, on what pedestal do we put our leaders? In a couple of weeks' time, we've got Stuart Blount coming. I was once in a transition phase, similar time to when the David and Elisha comment sits in. And I remember driving home, and I just dropped the kids off. There's no income. We're living in a barn. And I dropped the kids off at school, and I was driving home, and it was coming up towards Elam conference time, but about this time in 2018. And I'd moved on from the previous church because of a set of circumstances I won't go into, and it was 3 months without anything. And in Elam, what you do is you put your name on the stationing list. I'm ready to move to another church. And no calls. Stuart Blount was the head of ministry. He's supposed to do the placements. I was due a phone call with Stuart. The Elam conference was coming up in May, and usually what happens at the Elam conference is you get approached for a church if you don't have one. And so I'm sitting there twiddling my thumbs, and I drive home, and I've got a phone call due with Stuart that morning. And I pick up the phone with Stuart, and Stuart tells me there's nothing coming. There's nothing available for you. Don't get your hopes up. And I had a moment of, they don't care, do they? Put my hand on the door to walk in the barn. And God said, put your hope in Elam, did you? Whoosh. It was like being shot between the eyes. I remember sitting down in the little living room kitchen thing that we were in, having made myself a cup of tea. And I said to God, let's watch an episode of Top Gear together because I'm that spiritual. And we sat and watched Top Gear and talked. Yeah. Breakfast, right? And I resigned myself to the fact that, you know, I had to become okay with things not being okay. And I also resigned myself to the fact that, and I remember God speaking to me a few days later and said, if I never used you again, would you be all right with that? Blimey. I remember saying, yeah. Like I'm supposed to say yes, aren't I? But everything in me is like, no, really? Like, what was all of it for? You know, 10 years in the ministry, what's all of that for? What's all that about? I've got it figured out. Wind forward to Peter, leader of the church, denies Jesus 3 times in front of a crowd of people while warming himself by a fire. Warming himself by the fire made by his enemies. Warming himself in association with the servants and the officers of the high priest. Warming himself because he was cold. How uncomfortable for you, Peter. And yet, we can look down on Peter in this moment, and we can look down on his behavior as not being good enough. I would never deny Jesus, as if, like we think we're better than them, like we think we know better, because we got the stories, so if we were in the same situation, we wouldn't. Don't think so highly of yourself. You could find yourself in that position anytime. In fact, Peter's denial is public. It's headline news in the Christian world. What if some of your quote-unquote denials were headline news in the Christian world? How would you do? So I sat there in that living room watching Top Gear. But you hope in Elam, did you? And I thought, it wasn't fair for me to put that expectation on Stuart. He's just a man. He might be a man of faith and power for the hour that's going to be preaching in a few weeks, and like you can't book him for a year, and all of those things, but he's still just a man. And he would say that. And it was not fair for me to put the expectation for looking after the future of my life into other people's hands. It wasn't right for Peter to seize back control of the future of his life into his hands. Yeah, he did. And the way he dealt with his shame was he stood around the fire and just kept warm. Probably not really saying a lot. Trying to process it as he's going through. Of course, we, with the stuff that we wouldn't want printed in newspaper headlines, find ways to comfort ourselves and make like it's okay. Maybe it's we sing the songs and we clap our hands and look like it's all right. Maybe we preach from platforms and dig deep again and keep going. Maybe we just do the role that we do and welcome and put the I'm fine mask on, which everybody has in church. Maybe we just make sure we hold our head at the consecrated angle when the pastor preaches. I love that phrase. But we know deep down it's not okay. We're not all right. Like this, we know he's risen again. We know that he's died for our sins. We know we're going to eternity, but we're not okay. Like there's a fraction of us that's not in right relationship with God. There's a piece of our lives that's covered. There's a story of comforting ourselves around the fire in the midst of the denial. John doesn't want the story to end there, so he writes one more chapter. That's why I think he wrote this chapter. It's interesting as you read the text. It says they came away dragging the foot. So they got out of the. So when they had got out to onto the land, this is verse 9, eyesight. They saw a charcoal fire. Is there any other time in the Bible where you see the words charcoal fire? It occurs twice in the Bible. One at the denial, and one in this moment. John's saying Jesus brings Peter back to the comfort moment. Because the comfort he had previously was false. I'm trying to comfort myself by saying, at least I'm okay. At least I'm warm by the fire. At least I'm able to stand. At least I'm keeping myself comfortable. At least I'm making it like it's okay. At least I'm doing that. When it's not okay. There's a deep pain that's not okay. He's watching his world crumble in front of him. He's not okay. And now he winds forward, chapter 21. He's at the beach. He's gone fishing. Why? Because he goes back to what he knows. I couldn't be a good follower, but at least I can fish. And then he's had no luck again. And so the better fisherman, that was the carpenter, that's the rabbi, comes along and says, just throw your net on the other side. And he suddenly realizes who it is. So he closes up, he jumps out of the boat, even though it's by the shore. And I think John writes that it's by the shore because he's just like, Peter's a numpty. Can you not just, it's only 100 yards, Peter, and you're by the shore, but you've jumped out, you covered yourself up. Normally you wouldn't go swimming by wearing clothes. You'd take a few more off, right? But he's covered himself up, he's jumped straight in the water, and he's waded into Jesus. Why? Because he wants to get to Jesus. And we see the text here. He gets to Jesus, and he stops, and he doesn't want to know what to say anymore, because that's what happens when we get to our point where we need to start reconciling back with someone or with God, is we just, all we've got is how we feel. Can't put it in words anymore. Same happens in deep moments of feeling. We just run out of words to put to things. For blokes, it's just usually silence. Peter's gone to silence. Nothing coming out. Peter gets to Jesus, and Jesus has got this spread of fish. Somebody has taken the time to count how many fish that were caught, 153, which is fascinating. All sorts of thoughts around that. And so, but there's a spread and there's some fish cooking. Fried kippers, some bread. Jesus is cooking the food, invites them to all sit around the charcoal fire. I was Googling just before I came up, like, was it Sandy Beach or was it Pebble Beach? There's a bit of both around the Sea of Galilee, but I'd like to think it was sandy. So we're going with sand. And so charcoal fire, sand, they're all sitting down together. Group of them, it's quite a few disciples, and Peter's there. Jesus already dealt with Thomas. He's not taking the time to deal with Peter. So John sits in his study or wherever he's writing, and he writes down the words that Peter sat down. And at some point, Jesus turns to Peter, and he says, Peter, do you love me more than these? The word agape is the word love there. Am I first? Is there no condition on the love you have for me? Peter breaks a bit, and he says, you know I love you, Lord. Filio, friendly love. I'm your friend. Jesus says, do you love me more than these? There's interesting speculation in the commentaries as to whether he meant the disciples or the fish. And actually, if you think about it for a moment, he went fishing. Maybe he meant the fish. Like, do you love me enough to follow me again? Or are you still so crushed? All you can think about doing is going back to what you know. Going back to what's comfortable. Fishing in the shallows. No deep water for me. I failed him. Let's pause in that moment. Think about yourselves for a moment. Do you love me more than these? Do you love me more than the comfort
Do you love me more than the familiar? Do you love me more than that which you tied yourself to? You've gone back to, because you know you failed. Jesus is picking Peter's heart out of shame. He's literally picking him up out of his shame. And it's interesting that Jesus does not go through a psychological counseling session for Peter to focus on himself. Jesus' method of picking Peter out of his shame is to get him to focus on his love for God. And then in the words he says afterwards, tend my sheep, tend my lambs, if that's the word he uses. His love for others. That our shame will make us focus on ourselves, our own feelings, our own issues, our own protection, our own safety, back into the shallows, going back to what's familiar, going back to what's normal for me. That's where our shame will drive us away from the calling of God. We see it all the way in the garden, where they hid in their shame and their nakedness. And yet God steps into this moment with Peter around breakfast and a charcoal fire. Not a private session in the prayer corner in deliverance ministry. Good though all of those things are. Not in the middle of the big band worship session or at the end of a long sermon. God sits Peter down over breakfast as he walks towards the barn and puts his hand on the... Put your hope in Elam, did you? All right, let's have a cup of tea over Top Gear and sort this out. Like, how unspiritual is that? Like, if you're going to do it properly, do it at the synagogue. Don't do it at the beach over breakfast. And yet, this story, I love this story so much. This story, people often ask me, what's the first thing you do when you get to go to heaven? I said, I'm going to have breakfast at the beach with Jesus. Because John's saying, this is the last story I want to tell you. It's not a story of how great and amazing and resurrection and power. It's a story of reconciliation of hearts to God. That the way the story will carry on when John is gone is a story of reconciliation of hearts to God. It's a story of breakfasts after fishing. It's a story of dinner tables. It's a story of sitting around together and warming ourselves by the fire, being reconciled to God and to one another. Jesus says to Peter, after he said, do you love me more than these? He then, of course, Peter's couldn't quite reach the level of love that Jesus was talking about. Jesus said, do you love me? Again, using the word agape. And Peter says, you know I love you, Lord. And he uses the word phileo, which means friend. And so Jesus again renews the call, tend my lambs, feed my sheep. And then Jesus asked him one more time, because three times he denied, so three times he needed to be reconciled. Just to say, Peter, I've got this covered. My heart towards you is pure. It's you that have put the barrier in the way. And so Jesus turns around to Peter in the last phrase. He says, Jesus says, Peter, are you my friend? Because Peter couldn't reach the level of love Jesus was asking for. Jesus stepped down to the level of love he could give. And in that moment, Peter broke. You know I love you, Lord. Peter's restoration back into calling and ministry. You see it later. He says, follow me. Peter's restoration back into calling and ministry was not when Peter had publicly declared how much of a sinner and how wicked and evil he was and had gone through this whole process of public humiliation. It's already happened. It was not when he proved himself in ministry again. He was fishing, and he was even terrible at that. He forgot about putting it on the other side of the thing, and he could have got the fish then. Jesus had to tell him again.
That's how you do it, isn't it? Right? Down to a system. Peter had no system. He had no work that he could do. He had nothing he could do to make himself right with God. It was purely by the love and the grace and the majesty of Jesus. And so John is saying in these chapters, even in that moment, after 3 years of discipleship, where healings and miracles are abounded, and where he's seen the resurrected Christ and the calling, Peter needed to be restored in his heart back into public ministry. A few chapters later, we read about Peter standing in front of a crowd in Acts 2, proclaiming the gospel of Jesus, proclaiming the risen Christ, and 3,000 people. Some of them would have seen him warming his hands at the high priest's house. 3,000 people came to Jesus on that day. This is the same Peter. And this is what's gone on. Something's clicked in his heart. Where for some it was call, go, and they just went. For others, there needed to be stuff that was dealt with, and Jesus took the time to do it. And he's basically saying this: whoever you are, whatever you've been through, whatever faith you've expressed and story of history that you've got, story of ministry that you've got behind you, there will come moments where you reach that space where you need coffee with me. And I need to bring you around the coal fire where previously you warmed yourself in your denial. And I need you to bring you around that same fire. And we're going to go through this together. We're not going to go through this separate. We're going to go through this together. So come to the fire. Come and have some fish. Some of us is not into fish. I'll have barbecued lamb, please, Jesus. By the beach. I like barbecued mushrooms as well. That'd be good. I want my moment with Jesus. Come to Jesus. Sit with him. And he says some really interesting stuff afterwards. He says to Peter, there'll come a time and you won't be your own master anymore. Somebody else will lead you by the hand and take you where you don't want to go. And he describes how he'll be crucified. John records it, that Jesus told Peter what would happen to him. And this time Peter followed. But he didn't follow and say, I will go to my death. He had learned not to engage his mouth at that point. Because our words don't define our character, nor do they define our destiny. He does. And we have to receive what Jesus says about who we are and where we're at. True humility is not making yourself low. True humility is accepting the way Jesus describes you. It's making him Lord rather than you. And so Peter goes, and it's interesting that Peter has another moment, engages mouth before brain. Always will. I'm sure Jesus laughed. He turns and he says, what about this guy? Just in the last few moments, John writes this little bit about Peter goes, what about John? What's going to happen to him? It's the same thing that will happen to him. It's going to happen to me. Jesus doesn't actually say what would happen to him. John's making that really clear in this. He says, what concern of that is yours? And yet we in our Christianity and our walking with Jesus, what's going to happen with that pastor that fell? What's going to happen with that person now? Why are you bothered about that? You focus on what I've called you to do. Let me worry about them. And we sit in our judgment seat sometimes over people's lives. We sit in our high horse of we've made it in ministry and they haven't, or we've made it, we've read the Bible more than them, or we pray more. We've at least 15 minutes more prayer time than you have every day, so that makes me a better Christian. All of those sillinesses, we have them all, and because we all love a bit of self-righteousness. And Jesus is saying, get your eyes off him. Like, that's what got you in trouble in the first place, Peter. You made yourself comfortable by the fire because you had your eyes on everybody else's lives and not me.
Stop trying to make yourself feel better about yourself, Peter. Follow me. I'll take you where you need to go. I'll lead you. I'll speak into you. I'll lift you. I'll take your heart from where it is and make it shine. Trust me, Peter. And John then ends the book. He basically, I could tell you a load more stories. I'm not going to. He says, it will fill more books than the world will fill. I'll leave you with that one. Like, why did you write 21? John, why did you write 21? Like, you could have put it a few chapters earlier, couldn't he? Right? Oh, by the way, I'm going to tell the story in a bit, but I want to end with the resurrection. I went in with a bang. No, he ends with breakfast by the beach. Because that's what ordinary looks like. And yet, the ordinary life of going fishing with your mates can become a miraculous encounter with God. And as Christians, so often we chase the headlines. There's too much self-righteousness in the headlines. Jesus is looking at kippers for breakfast. He's looking for the dinner table with your family. He's looking for sitting in the board meeting or in the team meeting. He's interested in speaking into one another's lives at dinner tables and lifting one another and reconciling us back to God. And we can all do that. We don't need microphones or platforms or fancy clothes like mine. We just need a heart for Christ. And then an obedient heart attends the lambs. Tend my lambs. Let's reverse it. Who are his lambs? Who are his lambs? They're just a lamb. Oh, but they said this, they're just a lamb. Oh, but they did this, they're just a lamb. Oh, but you don't understand what they've said about me. They're just a lamb. But he didn't offer me anything, God, and I was looking forward to a conference where I might get offered something. They're just a man. Follow Jesus. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for this time together. And Jesus, I thank you for the example of grace. Thank you that your eyes were on Peter's heart and not his offense. Teach us to do likewise. Amen.